It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Barrett today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Door County's Midsummer Music Festival is celebrating its 25th year. We'll talk to the founder about what makes the event so unique and gives it a staying power.
First, the state budget is still stalled in the legislature because of several issues, including transportation funding. Governor Walker proposed borrowing $1.3 billion to fund transportation instead of raising taxes or fees.
Now, many state Republican lawmakers have said they don't agree with borrowing that much money. Yesterday, rural Republican lawmakers sent a letter to the governor saying they support cuts to his borrowing plan, but they can't allow those cuts to fall solely on rural areas of the state.
Representative Mary Chaya is with us to talk about that letter. She represents the 35th District, which includes Merrill and Tomahawk. She wrote the letter to Governor Walker. Representative Chaya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So why did you decide to write this letter to Governor Walker?
Well, I think that Governor Walker needs to know that rural legislators are not happy with the amount of bonding that's in the budget, and that if we support cutting it because we don't feel that the bonding is sustainable and it's not the way to go, but when we cut and those cuts are made, that they have to consider the impact to rural areas, outlying areas, and the economic impact that it would have.
So basically, if there's not as much bonding, then some of the projects that are on the table for roads in Wisconsin are going to have to go. And it sounds like you're worried that some of those cuts could disproportionately fall on rural Wisconsin. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there isn't a person in this building that doesn't realize the importance of the Zoo interchange. 350,000 cars a day go through there, and, you know, a lot of our goods and services. But having said that, the roads that are, you know, the agricultural roads for logging trucks, all of that, you know, it's just as important as to our economies in the rural area. If we're going to have economic independence in the rural areas and grow some of these businesses, we need an infrastructure.
Well, as you said, the Zoo interchange being the prime example, the busiest interchange in the state, and one that a lot of money depends on, revenue for the state of Wisconsin. So why shouldn't the money go to the busiest interchange?
Well, we understand that, but then it's not just the Zoo interchange, but then it's the northern leg of that, the Highway 43 North, and then it's 894, and then it's other projects in that area. And if we continue to fund those projects 100%, the rest of the cuts are going to have to come from the outlying areas. So we're saying, you know, maybe cut Highway 43 North out of the Zoo and maybe put 894 on hold and, you know, let some of that money go towards the rural areas where we still need the infrastructures also.
Well, to go back to that letter that you wrote, there were 33 GOP lawmakers who signed on along with you. What sort of message do you think that sends to the governor?
I think it sends a strong message. I mean, Governor Walker knows that, you know, we support the Republican agenda and we support a conservative agenda. But having said that, you know, we just need to emphasize that, you know, rural Wisconsin and the outlying part of the states, you know, we need our infrastructure as well as anyone else.
Now, you were talking about needing that infrastructure, some of the logging roads to have that to build revenue in northern and rural parts of the state. In particular, do you have projects in mind that you're worried would be on the chopping block if the bonding level gets cut?
Well, it's not really in my district, but it's a very important part of our state where Highway 29 meets 41 over in the Green Bay area. There's like a $30 million project that needs to get completed there, and there's a lot of businesses that depend on that. But even the basic road maintenance issues, I-39 going north, I mean, that is the main tourist destination for my district and north. That's the main artery coming in there. And then you can get over in the western part of the state. You've got Highway 13 that pulls off at 29 to get people up north. But in addition to that, we have a serious issue with deterioration of roads and log trucks, which are very heavy, a lot of the large farming equipment, and we need to keep those in good shape so that businesses will expand to that area and that commerce can flow.
Would you support raising taxes and vehicle fees to make up for that shortfall?
You know, I have to say this. I did not come to Madison to raise taxes on people. But when you raise the gasoline tax, it's actually a user fee. You know, if you're going to use our roads, you need to help pay for them. And by raising the gasoline tax maybe 3 to 5 cents, we're also capturing out-of-state money. And as I've done my spring surveys, people are okay with raising the gas tax now or even registration fees because our constitutional amendment doesn't allow for any robbing or raiding, I should say, of the transportation fund. And they know that money will go towards transportation infrastructure. So I would support that.
And some people have even suggested that maybe the time has come to think about toll roads. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that we should look into toll roads, but that's not really, you know, up to the state, because the federal government would have to give us a waiver in order to put toll roads in place, because there's some language that, and this is not verbatim, but because we accepted federal transportation dollars, then we're ineligible to put toll roads in. So that would have to be a federal waiver to allow us to even pilot it, or be one of the states that could pilot or take a look at it.
We're talking right now with Mary Chaya, Republican representative for Assembly District 35, talking about transportation funding now in Wisconsin. And Representative Chaya, not all GOP lawmakers feel the same way about this bonding. You're concerned about it. But if you take, for example, River Hills Senator Alberta Darling, she says the zoo interchange project has to remain on schedule because it would be a disaster if it were halted, and it's already underway. Do you think there is something to her argument there?
I think there's something to her argument, and Senator Darling is very familiar with that area. And again, you know, we understand the amount of commerce that goes through there, but what Senator Darling and some of my southeastern legislative friends have to take into consideration is there's not as much commerce that goes through certain roads or certain projects and areas, but there's still safety factors. And for the businesses that are there, whether or not they expand and stay in that area could very much depend on the infrastructure. So the dollar amounts might not be as high as far as commerce that travels, but that doesn't mean they're not just as important to those rural areas.
Now, right now we have a budget process that is stalled in large part because of transportation, mm-hmm. but also because of the Bucks Arena and prevailing wage law. And it seems as though there's a stalemate among the GOP, the Republican Party right now. What do you think it's going to take to get past that?
We had some very good conversations. We had a leadership meeting today, and I'm very optimistic that leadership in both houses will, you know, wrap their heads around where we're going to go with this, and I think there's a lot of common ground. It's just fine-tuning it. So it'll move in the next, in the near future, let me put it that way.
And do you consider it a pretty provocative move to directly go sort of head-to-head with the governor by sending him this letter?
No, because we're not drawing any lines in the sand. You know, that leadership is negotiating with the governor and, you know, with both houses. And this is just kind of a reminder to them, don't forget the importance of the outlying areas. We are not, you know, saying we're not going to vote for the budget or we're not going to this or we're not going to that. This is just to let them know how important it is to 33 of the assembly members.
Now, Governor Walker's office, his spokesperson, has responded saying essentially that this decision about where these cuts should show up should be handled by the Department of Transportation. Why don't you think those cuts should be left up to that agency?
Well, I think our agencies do a fairly good job on things of these issues, but we are the elected people. And there's more assembly people, so we're a little bit closer. We don't represent as many people, so we have the ability to, you know, maybe communicate with people. But we're still their elected representatives, and we're their voices. So we need to remind, you know, DOT might prioritize and what this would be cost effective in this one, but I don't know if they look at the nuts and bolts of the economic impact and how it really affects areas. And I think that's what we bring to the table, and that's our job. So that's why I don't think that DOT should have, you know, the full say in it.
Well, how optimistic are you that the governor will get this message and others in the legislature, including fellow Republicans, will hear you and maybe change their thinking about transportation funding, in particular in regards to the zoo exchange and rural roads?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, so I'm going to say I'm very optimistic on it. I think that, you know, Speaker Voss, I had a conversation with him regarding the letter, and he fully understands the importance that it is to rural areas. And he's done a great job with traveling to the different districts and stuff and really seeing what's important to us and how things affect us as we make decisions. Representative Nygren Representative Nygren's from a fairly rural area, and he understands. And this just isn't about roads. We have a tendency to think it's about roads, but it's our airports and it's our harbors. And we have to take into consideration that those have to be maintained. You know, the Superior and Green Bay, Milwaukee, all these different harbors that we have, there's a lot of goods that move through that. So it's broader than just truck traffic and vehicle traffic. So I think they will respond very well to it.
Representative Chaya, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate the call. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Mary Chaya, Republican representative for Assembly District 35, including Merrill and Tomahawk. She was with us to talk about a letter she wrote to Governor Walker, signed by other rural Republican lawmakers, about plans to fund transportation here in Wisconsin. As spring blossoms into summer, it's time for the Midsummer Music Festival, which celebrates its 25th anniversary this year.
On the shores of Lake Michigan, this Door County Festival offers dozens of classical chamber music concerts in unique venues like barns, historic churches, galleries, and even boathouses.
The organizers say the series takes classical chamber music out of large concert halls and places it in intimate and inspiring places to create a unique experience for music lovers.
Joining us now to discuss this is the co-founder and artistic director of the Midsummer's Music Festival, Jim Birkenstock, who's also a principal orchestral player with the Lyric Opera of Chicago. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, great to be with you.
So what inspired you to found the Midsummer Music Festival?
Well, we had just purchased some property here in Door County, and I guess as we looked about at all the beauty that we saw, we thought, boy, what if we could just marry this beauty with some great chamber music, and it just seemed like a wonderful opportunity.
And from the very beginning, were you imagining the idea of having these performances in unusual locations?
Yes. In fact, the first year we played only 5 concerts, but 2 of them were in private residences, open to the public. 2 of them were at the Hardy Gallery, which is in Ephraim and is out on the end of a dock surrounded by water.
Oh, wow.
A really unique venue. And one of them was a children's concert in the Ephraim Village Hall, a sort of Scandinavian-type structure right on the water in the center of Ephraim.
And part of the thinking behind this is it really is sort of reconnecting with the whole notion of chamber music in the first place, right?
Exactly. Somehow I think we got away from that at some point, and that had a negative impact on the way people viewed chamber music, and we were intent on getting back to the real roots of chamber music, as you alluded to. In the 18th and early 19th century, when the Industrial Revolution meant that there was a developing middle class, you had people who had some available time and perhaps a little available money. And without television and radio and other things to distract them, having music in the home was really a key thing. And they would perform with one another. They would invite friends over. Music was really, of that type, was very much viewed in a social context. Somehow, sometime in the 20th century, I think, maybe the idea of having a string quartet play in a concert hall that held 1,500 or 2,000 people
yeah.
may have seemed like a good idea, but it's totally different, as you well know.
Now, this has been going on for 25 years, so what do you think is responsible for its staying power over the years? Is it that, because it's a chance for people to sort of reconnect with the way that music should be heard, or is there more to it than that?
I think that's a good part of it, but first and foremost, we thought from the beginning this has to be really top caliber. So we invited some of the best players we could find, I think, literally in the country. We have 2 members of the Pro Arte String Quartet from the University of Wisconsin in Madison,
mm-hmm.
David Perry, our first violinist, and Sally Chisholm, violist. We have players from the Lyric Opera Orchestras you mentioned. I play in that orchestra. Our cellist, Walter Prusel. My wife, our flutist, just recently retired from there. We have a oboist from Milwaukee Symphony. So it's that caliber of player, and they're also wonderful colleagues. You know, in chamber music, it's so important that the musicians really work well together and enjoy each other's company, both socially and musically. And that's certainly true of this group. And it shows in the way the ensemble plays. People pick up on that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that the quality and that spirit comes through, and then you put that together with, as I said, the social context and just the beauty of the surroundings. We play in so many different venues, and it's hard to pick one over the other because every time you turn around, there's just some more glorious things to see.
Tell me about some of the places that you're performing this year. What are some of the interesting venues that you have in the lineup this year?
Well, we just played at the Clearing in Ellison Bay. We'll be playing there again a couple of times. That's an establishment that was created by Jens Jensen, the famous landscape architect who came from Denmark by way of Chicago. Hmm. He helped design the Chicago some of the Chicago Park District wonderful gardens along with Daniel Burnham.
Mm-hmm.
He created this learning retreat in Ellison Bay, about 180 acres, high on the bluff looking out over the waters of Green Bay. And nestled back in the woods is this schoolhouse, a sort of stone English Gothic kind of building. It looks almost like a chapel.
Oh, wow.
And so you arrive in a parking lot after driving through the woods on a gravel road,
uh-huh.
And then you walk along a sawdust path through the woods that winds to this little schoolhouse, just the right size for an audience of maybe 80 people or so.
Wow.
And
that sounds great.
Intermission, you can step outside, walk just a few steps to the edge of the bluff and look out over the water all the way to Michigan on the other side of the shore.
Wow, that's amazing.
And so what good kind of acoustics and a beautiful place to play, very inspiring.
So what kind of people show up for this? Are there the tourists from different places and stuff? Or
we have tourists for sure. We also have a pretty strong following of people who either live here year-round or have summer homes or seasonal homes. A lot of people that don't live here year-round come back in May and maybe stay into the fall colors. So they live here a good percentage of the time, and a lot of those are very keen supporters.
Now, how do you pick the music for it? Are you trying to get things that are accessible to people, or a combination of things, or?
Yeah, one of the things that we do is we're a mixed chamber ensemble, so we have winds, strings, and piano. We have 20 musicians on our roster this year. We don't ever use all 20 at one time, but we very intentionally program so that if you hear a concert, you'll probably not hear any two pieces on that concert for the same combination.
We mix
it up, so you're getting a lot of variety of sonorities and textures, and then we also mix up the styles. So there's a lot of variety. We like to say that the music sense of the music is always changing, kind of like the Door County weather.
And you're also doing a Big Top event this year, right?
We are. Part of our 25th anniversary celebration. That's July 12th. That's a Sunday afternoon. It's the first time we've ever done anything like this. This is going to have a lot more variety to it than even our regular concerts. And it's on a 51-acre beautiful rolling estate between Bailey's Harbor and Ephraim.
Wow, that sounds great. Now, where do people go to get more information or find tickets for this?
They can visit our website, midsummersmusic.com.
Okay.
Or our phone number is 920-854-7088.
Well, that sounds really great, Jim. Thanks for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Jim Birkenstock. He's the co-founder and artistic director of the Midsummer Music Festival. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. According to a recent article on preventing sexual assault, a new Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation poll found that 1 in 5 young women who attended college in the past 4 years say they've been sexually assaulted, and 2/3 of those survivors say they've been drinking before the assault.
With statistics like that, parents can be left wondering what they can do to help. And the research shows that parents that have one especially powerful technique to use, talking to their kids about sexual assault. Parents who talked to their kids about the issue had kids who were safer in college.
Here to tell us about that research and share advice for what works is Bridget Schulte. She's a staff writer at the Washington Post, a fellow at the New America Foundation, and the author of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. Bridget, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the statistics on this are pretty alarming. So why would something as simple as talking to your kid about sexual assault be effective?
Well, I think it's really important on two levels, really. And the first is that you're bringing it out into the open, because more than anything, you know, all the statistics, whether alcohol is involved or not, what so much of the research shows is that what we really need to do is change the culture. And the only way you change the culture is by bringing it into the open and talking about it. And that's talking to both men and women. You know, for so long we've looked at sexual assault as something that only women need to worry about, or we've had sort of this blame the woman kind of advice. And so what's really important is that we look at that we're talking on these two levels, that we're looking at men and women and changing the culture, where it's, you know, you look at so many movies, it's so funny to talk about, you know, when you get drunk, you go after the woman who's the drunkest at the party, and that's how you score. And until we get to the point where that's not funny anymore, there are things on this other level, sort of a very practical level. So what do you do? And the research shows that when you're open with both your children, your men and women going off to college, it does serve as a protector.
Can you give us a sense of the kinds of things that parents would say both to young women and to young men?
Well, for the most important thing is really understanding consent. You know, no means no, really understanding, you know, what is yes, and understanding that when one or both of you have been drinking, neither one of you are really in a position to make, to get to that yes, to get to that real solid sense of consent, that this is something that you both have agreed on. So it's understanding that for both men and women. For women, some of it is very, very practical. Some of the research shows that the most dangerous time for young women in particular is the first few weeks of freshman year. In studies that have been done about who is perpetrating sexual assaults, they've found that it tends to be a very small group of who they call serial rapists. And they tend to target freshman girls who don't really know how things are working, and maybe flattered by attention, because they tend to be popular, and they kind of hide in the culture where this is sort of accepted. And so understanding that those first few weeks you need to be on your guard is something that the sociologists who've looked at this, Elizabeth Armstrong in particular, has found that the girls who have had the most success, if you will, really listened to their parents, who said, You know, don't drink from an open container. Always have a battle buddy where you go. Don't go upstairs by yourself, no matter how nice the young man might seem. So again, I think it's important to understand these are practical things that you can do, that the that you can talk to your girls, but understanding that still leaves it in the kind of, I don't want to say blame the woman zone, but that's only part of it. We all need to be looking at a much larger cultural change, talking with administrators, teachers, fraternities,
right,
sororities, and students.
And what do you make of the fact that we're seeing that this is effective for parents to do, and we're not actually putting the burden to put some of these things into place on the colleges? For instance, if there's a small group of serial rapists that target women their first few weeks of freshman college, why are parents supposed to educate and not colleges?
That's a really good question. And actually, one of the things that's been happening, there's been an increasing, again, because of talking. And I think this is where talking and bringing awareness is really a very important first step. There have been more federal investigations into sexual assault on campuses that sort of turned up the heat on administrators. And there have been some really interesting education programs. They call it bystander education programs for both men and women on campuses to help students begin to recognize when things might be getting out of hand and what are some things that they can do in ways that are not going to expose them and sort of like put them in the out group, because it's always such a touchy thing. You know, you want to be sort of in the in group in college. So that there are certain things that you can do, like at a party, if things look like they're starting to go off the rails, you turn off the music or you turn on the lights, and it doesn't necessarily have to be you making a big deal out of it, but you kind of disrupt it, and it teaches you to be a much more active bystander rather than just kind of watching things and feeling helpless.
So there are programs like that, but it sounds like at the core of a lot of the issues around sexual assault, not all, but a lot, is the problem of alcohol. Some people have called it the real date rape drug. How much of that, these talks, needs to talk about alcohol literacy?
Well, that's a really good question. When you talk to survivors, one of the things that they'll say is like, it wasn't the alcohol, it was him. The Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation poll found not only just 1 in 5 women who have been recently in college reported some kind of sexual assault, but 1 in 20 men as well. And there's a whole lot of shame around, around their situation. They feel like they can't talk about it, or that people don't understand. But the thing with alcohol, it is so ubiquitous on college campuses. I think that's one of the reasons why parents feel like, they have to give their children sort of like lessons, if you will. Like, if you're going to drink, drink responsibly. Don't drink to incapacitation. Because Harvard has been studying drinking on college campuses for years, and binge drinking is huge. It's really just part of the college culture, and there have been efforts to try to stop that, and they really haven't been successful. There's wet campuses and dry campuses, and there's binge drinking on both.
And is it realistic then to think that we can ever decouple sex from alcohol? You were talking about consent before and how those lines get confusing when there's alcohol involved, but how do you ever decouple the two?
Yeah, I think that goes back to really having a culture change and really talking about things. That it is, that just because someone is, a young girl is incapacitated does not mean that she is open for business. You know, and again, I just think of like, think of the popular movies out there that young boys in particular see all the time, Superbad or, the 40-Year-Old Virgin. There are all sorts of jokes about how that's the one that you want to go after and score. And so this is part of this larger conversation. Until that doesn't become funny anymore, this is something that, that people are going to have to watch out for, and parents are going to have to warn their children about.
Well, we're talking about how parents can help prevent sexual assault by talking to their kids about it. Bridget Schulte is with us from the Washington Post. And Bridget, is this a comfortable conversation for most parents to have. They're not only talking about sex, which is difficult to have a conversation about, they're talking about sexual assault. Are most parents up to this?
You know, this is really one of the most difficult conversations that you could have. You know, first of all, when you talk about alcohol, you know, alcohol, it's illegal to drink in this country until you're 21. And so to sit down and have a realistic conversation with your child is almost sort of saying, listen, it's illegal, but I know you're going to do it, because that's the bottom line, is that's going to happen. You know, everybody who's gone to college remembers, you know, the keg parties or the Everclear in the garbage can and the dorm room. It is ubiquitous. And so that is part of what makes it uncomfortable, is that you know, kids may not want to admit to their parents that they've had a beer, or it is very uncomfortable. And you're talking about sex to both boys and girls who may not want to talk to their parents about it, or kind of roll their eyes. I think that's one of the things that the sociologists found, is that they were difficult conversations. It didn't, you know, the parents may not have thought that the students were listening. They kind of would roll their eyes, or like, oh, I know, or, you know, shut up, mom. And yet they did listen, because they followed the advice and they did find it protective.
So how much safer are the kids who've had this kind of talk from sexual assault?
Well, you know, some of the work is qualitative, and so it's difficult to, you know, to kind of like, you know, come up with a certain sort of percentage. But from the qualitative or anecdotal data, the parents who did have those conversations, the students kind of walked in with open eyes, and that the students who had the most difficult time or were more at risk really came from parents who were in denial or were too embarrassed to talk, or maybe too naive to understand what really happens on college campuses.
Bridget Schulte is with us now. She's a staff writer at The Washington Post, and you can find a link to her piece about this issue on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about how parents can help prevent sexual assault by talking to their kids about it.
And we'd like to hear from you. Did you have a talk with your kids about how to stay safe from sexual assault when they were teenagers or before they went out to college? You know what to say? Maybe you're thinking about having a conversation but can't quite figure out how to break the ice. Well, we'd like to hear your thoughts and comments and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post your comments to the Central Time Facebook page.
We're taking a look at what parents can do to prevent sexual assault, especially with kids going off to college and alarmingly high rates of sexual assault there. The good news is smart and honest talk with parents can help keep kids safer. Bridget Schulte stays with us. She's a staff writer for The Washington Post and a fellow at the New America Foundation.
And we want to hear from you. Did you have a talk with your kids about how to stay safe from sexual assault when they were teenagers or before they went off to college? Or maybe you're a college student and you had that talk and you think differently. We'd like to hear your story. Tell us what you think. 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We have Heather on the line in Clear Lake. Hi, Heather.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for talking about this, and I think it's so important to be talking about. My mom talked to me. I went to boarding school for high school, and my mom talked about it for me, with me. She knew I was going to boarding school for high school, and she talked about it probably from the age 10 on and kept that conversation going, and I just think that's so important. I also have a background in, and by the way, it also made a difference in the choices that I made looking back, even in dating and all of that. She just kept that conversation open, and I have a background in child protection too as a social worker, and the more you can talk to your kids, the more you can prevent things like that, and making it normal and to be talked about. I just think that's huge. So
interesting. From age 10 on, can you give us an example of a choice that you might have made differently because you had that conversation?
Well, I think it really influenced even the kinds of parties I went to, or the kinds of, in boarding school there wasn't a lot of parties per se, but the kinds of friends and the people, like, I just was very aware of my surroundings always and making sure I was in control of my choices.
Heather, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing your experience with us. And Heather, her mother started very young with her. Do you think, Bridget, that there's any evidence that it pays to get started with these conversations earlier?
Well, I think each family, it really has to look at their own circumstances, their, you know, their own children, their own relationship with them. I do think it's really important. This really that really highlights how important it is to keep a relationship with your children so that you can have these conversations and be heard. So you're not just like harping on them about homework, you know, that you really stay in conversation with your kids. And sometimes we get so busy, we forget to do that, because then when it comes time to have this difficult conversation, you'll have the relationship to build it on. And you can even say, look, I know you don't necessarily want to hear this from me, but you know, have that relationship and try to have this conversation more than once. Maybe you don't need to start at age 10, but the kids do listen. You know, they may not seem like they are, or they may not seem like they want to hear it. But I think Heather's story shows, and some of the research shows, that they do listen, they do follow it, whether it's subconscious and in terms of like, well, I don't think I'll go to this party, or, talking to other friends. It's like, well, my mom said don't do this. Well, my dad says don't do that or do this. They really are listening.
All right, well, let's go back to our phones. Now we've got another call. This is from Bill in Sun Prairie. Bill, hi.
Hey, I just want to say thanks. We were driving, and I heard the promo for the show, and it reminded me, and I had the conversation with the, well, it was directed at my 13-year-old, mm-hmm. but the other three kids in the car, you know, actually ended up asking a whole bunch of questions, and it led into a whole half-hour-long discussion about,
wow.
Underage drinking and how not to get yourself into situations that you can be vulnerable and taken advantage of. And, and of course, my son that we started the conversation with, reminding him, hey, you're not invincible. You're not immune to this.
So you just had this big conversation, Bill. That's so interesting. What did your kids, did it go well, and what did they ask you?
Yeah, it went reasonably well. I mean, we have some younger school-age kids, so, I mean, it got a little bit silly, too. But we did bring it back to the serious side that, you want to be on the lookout and in those situations. Don't get don't imbibe in alcohol so much that you can't take care of yourself or the people around you. You got to be aware of your surroundings. Don't go out alone. And put yourself in a dangerous situation.
All right, Bill. Well, thank you for calling. And so thanks for sharing your experience. Really had made a difference immediately there for Bill and his car full of kids. And Bridget, I don't want to let you go before we talk a little bit about how to, because you've got some bullet points that parents should talk about that are especially effective. Can you walk us through some basics for how to have one of these conversations like Bill just had and how to make sure that it goes well?
Well, sure. I think one of the first things is to really acknowledge that alcohol is part of campus life, whether you want it to be or not, to not be in denial. Just like, look, you are going to be going to parties and there is going to be alcohol. And so it's really important to, if you're going to drink, drink responsibly. Hopefully you're having those conversations when they start to drive, so that if you're going to drink or have a beer, do not drive. And hopefully you're having those conversations in high school. But really talk about, don't get to the point where you're so incapacitated that you make yourself vulnerable if you're a woman. Don't get so incapacitated if you're a young man that you can't make good judgments about, what's going on and in front of you. So to have both of those conversations with boys and girls, with men and women, and again, for really letting both men and women know the first couple weeks of school are really to be on your guard, to make sure that, if you're a guy, that you are on the lookout, that you are sort of a you're all in this together, that you're going to be a sort of an upstanding bystander, if you will, for women, to have a battle buddy, to, if you're going to go to a frat party, don't go alone, don't go upstairs by yourself, don't drink from an open container, make sure that if you're going to drink a beer, you've opened it yourself, Make sure that you know what's in, you're drinking out of a clear glass, perhaps. So you'll see if anybody's going to, slip something in there. And really be very clear about your sexual boundaries. To have those kinds of conversations with your children so that they begin to know themselves. What is it that I want? What do I feel comfortable with? And how do I communicate that?
And Bridget, as we wrap up, I mean, not all parents will have the same comfort level. Is it a good idea, to rehearse this ahead of time or to, write down little cheat notes for yourself if you're a parent before you have this talk?
I'd say whatever works, because these are tough conversations. Alcohol is illegal till they're 21. We'd rather they don't drink, but there is alcohol all around. Lots of us, have different views about sexuality, and many people wouldn't like their children to be, having sex, but many of them are. So it takes sort of a level of kind of like, and you can even say that, look, this is my vision, this is what I would like, and this is why it's difficult for me, but we both know what you're going into, and the most important thing is for both of you, men and women, that you come out safe and whole.
Bridget, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Bridget Schulze, staff writer at the Washington Post. She's also a fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of the book Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has a Time. And don't forget, if you're interested in reading a bit more, you can read Bridget's piece about preventing sexual assault by talking about it with your kids over on the Central Time Facebook page. Okay, so Wisconsin might not be the hippest state in the union. It might not have the lowest overall cholesterol levels or the most desirable climate. But you know what it does have? Tonight, my friends, it has the Rolling Stones. For the first time in 10 years, the Stones are playing Summerfest in Milwaukee.
Yep, the guys in the band are a little older, a little more grizzled. But that doesn't change the fact that their show sold out in 7 minutes, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Mick Jagger probably has an easier time fitting into those leather pants than most guys his age. You might even say that his ancient song is true.
It does kind of seem like time is on their side. How do these guys do it?
I don't know. I don't know how they do it, but they obviously, he knew. He knew. Years ago, time is on my side. That song is probably from like the 60s, right? And he knew at that point that years and years and years later, we'd come running back to him.
So he's optimistic. The secret is positive thinking for the Stones.
Something. I don't know. It's obviously powerful and powerful for the crowd. And hopefully they won't be as unruly as the Kenny Chesney crowd was
in
Green Bay.
I hope for the best. I don't know. Maybe the age demographic will skew a little older at the Stones concert.
Yeah, I'm hoping that they'll behave themselves. But it should be a lot of fun when the Stones play in Milwaukee tonight. So if you're there, have a good time.
Coming up next, news from NPR and WPR. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Central Time continues on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.